or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nimco.
Richard Nelson Bowles is the author of What Color Is Your Parachute?, which is the biggest-selling career guide of all time, over 10 million sold. The Library of Congress named it one of the 25 books that have most shaped readers' lives. He's been on the show before to discuss the book, and although there's a new edition of it, it just came out, I'd like our discussion this morning to focus on something else. Dick Bowles and I have lunch a couple of times a year, and our conversations are a lot more wide-reaching than just plain old career advice. And I do find our lunches fascinating, so I thought I would bring him on the show again this morning so you can hear one of those conversations. And we're going to tackle maybe America's most difficult jobs questions, the macro questions. For example, how should we deal with what is likely a long-term jobless non-recovery or minimal recovery? Dick Bowles, welcome back to Work with Marty Nimco.
Thank you, Marty.
Well, most experts agree that we are in a long-term jobless non-recovery or minimal recovery because we have enormous global competition we didn't have before, and we are deciding to impose ever greater costs of hiring in the United States. For example, the new health care mandates are going to mandate that employers are paying not only for their employees' health care, but an additional surcharge for the unemployed. First of all, do you agree that we are in a long-term jobless non-recovery or minimal recovery?
Well, yes, and it would take an idiot to deny it. But there is a distinction to be made, and that is the case of the nation as a whole and the case of individual job hunters. There's a big distinction between the fate awaiting those two different publics entirely.
Explain that.
Well, for example, the U.S. publishes the first Friday of each month a statistic which is called the unemployment statistic. Mm-hmm. Actually, what it is it's a measure of how much net the size of the workforce has changed in the U.S. from the previous sounding a month ago. And so they take the size of the workforce this month, they subtract from that or whatever the last month, and they get this figure. For example, in February of 2009, they said that the size of the U.S. workforce had shrunk by 726,000 people. So therefore, of course, the newspapers, the media, and others screamed how many jobs have been lost. But the government also, in another report that's hidden on the Internet, it's called JOLT, J-O-L-T, reported that that same month, 4,360,000 people had found jobs. And at the end of the month, there were still 3,006,000 vacancies remaining unfilled. So when you hear about the plight of the country, with its maybe permanent class of unemployed people or people who just have no job hunting skills, the impression you're left with is that the workforce is continually shrinking, and by these monthly unemployment reports, you're given the impression it's useless to go job hunting. Actually, since there were 7 million opportunities to find jobs in a typical month, and I chose February of 2009 deliberately because that was the very height of the recession, individuals can find hope if they raise their job hunting skills from elementary to more advanced skills. There's hope that among those 7 million vacancies, they can find particular positions. But if you look at the size of the problem nationwide, you have to say that as a nation, there's not that much hope as there is for an individual job hunter who's going out there trying to look for work. So we face the kind of situation we have politically as a nation coming up in, 23, 22 days, where you know the nation as a whole is going to say, we've got to do something about this, and they're going to try to get everyone in office, out of office, or as many as they can, because they have a fundamental hope that somebody knows the answer to this.
Okay.
In terms of a long-term unemployment problem as a nation, absolutely, and it's going to have political repercussions and everything else. But that doesn't mean hopelessness for the individual job hunter necessarily.
Okay, so what you're saying in essence is, while we are certainly losing net total jobs, there's nonetheless, there is some hiring, there is more firing and layoffs and offshoring, but there is some hiring going on. So for the individual, the key is he or she, they're going to be fighting for fewer jobs, more job hunters fighting for fewer jobs. So you better know how to do it really well, this job searching thing, or you're dead meat. Is that the point?
Yeah, because most people have elementary job hunting skills, and they're fine if we're in a prosperous time. They're adequate for the problem, and people do go on the Internet and send out their resumes and all that, and they do find jobs rather easily. What a recession or the post-recessionary period that we're currently in reveals is that the skills that were sufficient for you in a prosperous time simply are not sufficient in a negative time such as we're in right now. And this is likely, as you were saying at the very beginning of the program, this is likely to continue for years.
Right. So let's really, you know, the listeners to this show, because this show has been about career, and we've been on for we're starting our 24th year.
Congratulations, Marty.
Yes, thank you. They've heard what I would call the intermediate course, that we need multiple approaches to looking for jobs. You need to use some cold calling. You need to use networking. You need to use, you know, the headhunters as appropriate, you know, answer ads as appropriate. It's, you know, so we know that that's kind of the intermediate course. You just can't answer ads. But if you were to delineate, to list the 1, 2, or 3 super advanced techniques that in this permanent jobless non-recovery you would think are generally most useful to put into the quiver of job search tools, what would they be?
They all have one word in common, work. The first is work smarter, the second is work harder, and the third is work longer. That's where the job hunting force in America is most efficient. They aren't used to having to work so hard in order to find a job. And they, to go back to my 3 points, by work smarter, I mean there is all kinds of information we know about how to go about the job hunt. I can hardly think of another human activity that's been as much studied and researched
right.
as job hunting.
Right.
And I give as one quick example of that. We know that if you only use one method of job hunting, 51 out of 100 are going to get discouraged and drop their job hunt by the end of by the middle of the second month. We know if they use 2 or more methods of job hunting, only 33 out of 100 are going to give up. So we know niceties about the job hunt, which if somebody's going to work smarter, they've got to familiarize themselves with this so they aren't spinning their wheels or wasting time on methods that don't work very well, as in the current time, looking for jobs on the Internet, which has a terrible, terrible record overall
for most people.
So that's work smarter. Work harder, they did a survey.
Well, let's hold on. Let's, before we go on to the next one here. So work, you know, work smarter in my, here's my definition of it, and let's see to the extent to which you agree. To me, there are these 5 job search methods, that is, or 4, which is cold contact, using your existing network, answering ads, using headhunters, I guess those 4. And the ratio to which you should use them depends on your strengths.
Yes.
If you're a good networker, you network more. And you have a big network. If you are not afraid of cold calling and can think on your feet and write proposals to get jobs created, you'd spend more time on that. If you're bad at those things, you spend more time answering ads and do a really good job of showing how you document how you can find the really on-target ads and answer the ads appropriately. If you are a high-level person, yes, then you can use headhunters. If you are really, if you're not unemployed, but you are well-employed but simply looking to switch, then a headhunter might be interested in you, but the ratio will depend on you. That is my definition of job-seeking smarter. Would you agree, disagree, or amplify?
In general, I agree with you. Sure.
Okay. Then let's talk about working harder. You said that's working smarter. The
working harder, I can give you a very simple example. They did a survey last April of college graduates who had to go back and live with their parents because they couldn't immediately find a job after they got out of college.
Right.
And they did a survey of them to ask them how much time they were spending on their job hunt, and the average was 1 hour a week.
Really? Wow. That surprises even me.
Yes. It was astonishing.
An hour a week?
That's what I mean by working harder. You couldn't even look for a lost dog just 1 hour a week.
If I were to say, my rule of thumb is if you are working full time, you should be spending 15 hours a week looking for a job. If you're unemployed, you should be spending 30. Would you agree to disagree?
I think those are minimum estimates, yes, particularly in the case of you're not employed. I think every morning a job hunter should be sitting down and going over the things they need to go over. The first thing above all else is inventorying what it is they have to offer, by which I mean take the job title off it and ask what are the irreducible minimums of, say, the building blocks of a job that they do well and enjoy most doing. They ought to be spending their morning doing the inventory and figuring out, given that, once they've finished that kind of an inventory, it could be done in a good weekend if you worked hard at it, once they finish that, they have to figure out, how do I find out what the names are of jobs that let me use these skills? And that's the morning.
Let's back up on that for a minute.
Yeah.
You know, we have the people who have really good technical skills and can inventory, oh, yes, I can program in Python, or no, I have an MD degree and I've been a leader in corporations. They can do that. But so many of the people who tend to need career help have what I call generic skills. They are organized. They are good at dealing with people in broad sense, you know, in all contexts. They like dealing with people. They are generically bright. They think quickly. They learn quickly. They have some combination of what I call these soft generic skills. And, you know, I think one of the areas that you and I have disagreed over the years is that it is a mistake to spend too much time parsing those individual skills because so many of them correlate so heavily with each other. Do you want to push back on me on that?
Sure. Four times a year, I spend 5 days with a whole group of job hunters. I spend 5 days with them. That's morning, noon, and night. And I've learned that everyone can learn to do some self-inventory. You may have to vary it. For example, they may have to speak into a tape recorder and let good friends listen to it and tell them what skills they hear.
That's not my question. My question is that effort to worth all of that time? Doesn't it end in the end come down to either your hard skills and or am I mainly a word person? Am I mainly an entrepreneur? Am I mainly an artistic person? Am I mainly a social person? Does it really need to? Is parsing it down into far greater, forgive the term, granularity, is that really likely to translate into making a more effect, getting you a good job faster?
Well, I can't really answer that question. I can only tell you how I hear the question. I'm not sure I'm hearing it the way you're asking it. I've learned that human nature is basically lazy. That is to say, we don't want to work harder than we need to. So I always say, if you're able to find a job doing the kind of minimal inventory that I'm sure you would agree to as most people are capable of, maybe it's just 3 minutes or 5 minutes, and that gets you a job, fine. You only need to dig down deeper if you're having trouble finding a job, and then you're more motivated to figure out, well, what now can I do? Because the absolute key idea in job hunting is how much of what is happening to me lies within my own control. How much of it? Maybe 3%, it may be 5%, but how much of it lies within my control, and then within that domain, what can I do about it?
So I want to reframe that question. So where we differ, and I want our listeners to get both of these perspectives. In my judgment, if we're looking at a pool of people who have been unsuccessful in looking for jobs, I would argue that the additional work and time, and I couldn't agree more that this, you know, that you need to spend a lot of time on it, that the additional time should be spent trying to make contacts. You're saying that if you've been an unsuccessful job searcher, it's worth a weekend or longer to further inventory your skills to gain greater granularity. Does that define the difference between us?
Not sure, because I was only using the weekend as a measure of how much time it took. What I said was the job, you said the job hunter who's unemployed ought to be spending 30 hours a week on their job hunt.
Mainly looking for new contacts.
My definition of a minimum. I said in the morning they ought to be doing the self-inventory, and in the afternoon they ought to be getting out there and knocking on doors and being proactive in terms of trying to find vacancies that they can apply for. Or maybe the place likes them when they walk in. And they create a job for them. That's happened very, very many times.
Okay. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. I'm talking with Dick Bowles, officially Richard Nelson Bowles, the author of the premier book in career self-help, What Color is Your Parachute? Over 10 million sold, and it's now in its new 2011 edition. So, you know, you say getting out there. That is, and we're going to look, and I promise the listeners at the top of the show, we are going to quickly move to the larger macro questions of what America needs to do as a society for the hundreds of millions of people who are not the knowledge workers, the creative class, the entrepreneurs. There's 150 million folks who in this ever more competitive global economy are going to have a hell of a time finding decent employment with, you know, livable wage and benefits, et cetera. We're going to talk about that. But let's finish this kind of...
Well, let me interject something right there.
Yes.
I'm not disagreeing with your basic thesis that you just enunciated. All I'm saying is my first concern is that when we discuss this problem, we don't rob job hunters of their hope.
Right. Fair enough.
We have to fix that first in their minds and say, yes, there are 7 million jobs turning over each month, and there's no reason why you can't be one of the 7 million that find those jobs. There's a lot of what the experts call churn in the job market. So I want to anchor that so that our whole discussion doesn't leave people leaving the broadcast saying, oh, my God, I heard these two experts, and there's no hope for me. I can't possibly find a job.
Precisely.
But once we've anchored that, then we want to turn and talk about this whole readjustment of the global economy, because the minute the Internet was invented, the minute any kind of exchange of workers between countries, it's not only that we send some of our jobs overseas, it's that overseas send some of their jobs here. So we're not the only nation that has that problem. Once that happened, once you had the global economy, then, for example, wages had to be compared. What are the wages that workers earn for a particular kind of work in one country versus those wages those same workers would earn in another country? And it was inevitable and will be inevitable there would be a shaking down period where there's a more equalization of wages in terms of the world economy. And that's going to produce a class of people who are sort of the lost generation. There's no question about that.
We're going to talk about that later. We'll talk about how in the world Americans can compete with the world. Most of the world lives on a dollar a day. And how can Americans compete in a global economy with people who are living on a dollar a day? But first, let's stay. I agree with you. Let's give people in America, individuals listening to the show, concrete hope. So, as you say, a major, you know, whether you spend a lot of mornings or one morning or 20 minutes identifying your skills, you correctly point out, of course, that you've got to get your butt out virtually and in person to network, cold call, etc. But millions of people, especially disproportionately represented by job searchers, are terrified of going out there, walking in, sending cold emails, making cold phone calls, don't have a network, they're not prepossessing, they may be very ugly and fat or shy or don't think on their feet, or any combination of which will, in this ever more high-pressured, high-standards world, is going to make them not be able to network successfully. What do you say to them?
Well... I don't say anything generic. I try to talk to the individual when I'm being asked to counsel, and I get loads of emails asking me what to do in this situation or that situation.
So it's me. Let's role play. It's me. I'm coming to you. I'm not generic. I'm. Let's say I'm somebody who's kind of shy. Let's say I am obese, and I know in this lookist society, people who are obese don't get the same attention. Every study has shown that people who are thin and attractive are do much better in networking and in job searching and everything else. So I say, Dick, I'm obese. My whole family has been obese. I'm kind of, I don't know if that's made me shy, but I'm shy. I have very few friends. I desperately need a job. I was an accountant and then they closed down the office and sent all the jobs to India. I wasn't the worst employee. I wasn't the best. I can get an okay reference from my previous employee. I was average. What do I do, Dick? I'm scared to death. I'll be a bag lady.
First thing that I tell people in that situation is that there are two kinds of employers. There are employers that simply won't hire them, given the facts you just deduced, and there are employers who will hire them. They might, for example, safely assume that an obese employer would hire an obese person, and they'd probably be right. So there are some employers that will not be bothered by the handicap. Probably that's a minority among all the employers out there, but they have to go out and look for those employers who will not be bothered by that handicap and not get the mindset.
But I'm shy. I don't have a lot of connections. You say, go out there. What am I going to do? You know, even if I tried to walk into an accounting firm, there is the receptionist there. I couldn't even get past the receptionist. And she'll tell me to go to human resources. And I what do you mean go out there? And I'm shy. What am I going to do?
Well, I've been shy all my life, Marty, so I'm particularly apt to speak to that problem.
Okay.
We have a technique we use, and, I was going to make a side comment. I'll save it for later. We have a technique we use, which we call informational interviewing, where they simply go out, and they can go out with another person, and they try to find out information about the kinds of jobs they would like to do, not necessarily with this employer, but they're looking for information. You can take people with you, and you can watch how they deal with the questions and the answers and so on, because you're not, at that moment, actually there to apply for a job. You're there to try to understand what the job market is like and as it affects you. And you get over the shyness. I mean, I send people out, as I mentioned, these workshops I do in my home four times a year, I send people out all day in each of those workshops, and they are shy people, and they come back feeling victorious because they learn that if they have somebody else they can watch doing it, they don't find it to be such a barrier, and after a while they take over in the talking and they start to feel much more powerful vis-a-vis that handicap.
What do you think about for shy people using things like LinkedIn and Twitter and blogging and et cetera as a way of making it easier to make that initial connection rather than in person if you are a shy person?
Well, I always would counsel people to take that road, always. Okay. I mean, in job hunting, you don't try to find the most difficult way to go job hunting. You try to find the easiest way. That's instinctual to human nature, and it should be applauded and encouraged. If you can do it with less work, do it. But if you use LinkedIn and Plaxo and the other things, and that doesn't turn up a job for you, then you have to have a fallback strategy. Many people don't. They don't have any plan B. So they try the one thing, say, I'm very shy, I try LinkedIn, nothing happens, and I get discouraged, and then I give up. So as a first strategy, I would always go on the Internet and use the things the tools that have come available, particularly in the last 5 years or less. But if that doesn't work, then I would say I've got to get out there, and I need to go with somebody that knows how to present themselves, and I need to sit and listen as they work, and then I need to take over gradually and learn the skill. I have to learn that skill.
Okay. Now, before I go, I want to go to the larger macro societal question, but one more, I want to do a little thought experiment. Let's say Dick Bowles is now 40 years old. He has not written What Colors Your Parachute. He doesn't have a degree from MIT. He's not an ordained Episcopal minister, priest. He is a typical Richard Nelson Bowles is, say, a 40-year-old who was a journalist, because you are a writing kind of guy, and your newspaper, as so many newspapers and other media outlets, went out of business. And you have your degree of a bachelor's in journalism from San Francisco State. But you know what you know about Richard Nelson Bowles, and you know about job hunting. What actually would Richard Nelson Bowles, at age 40, with that BA in journalism, with the newspaper having gone out of business, what would, moment by moment, what would Richard Nelson Bowles do to try to find himself a job?
I would first of all assume somebody with my same kind of a background has successfully gone before me and found a job, so I'm going to look for that kind of person.
How are you going to find? Good, very good. How are you going to find him or her?
Well, I'd start with LinkedIn. I would say I would contact all the people that I've made a link with, and I would say, who do you know? Do you know of some journalist with this kind of a background who has successfully navigated into a new job? What field did they go into? How did they go about finding it? I would try to find their history as much as they would tell me about it to learn from it.
Very good. What else would you do?
I would pray a lot, but you probably don't want to hear
That's fine. No, I want to know what Richard Nelson Bowles, nobody else, I care about you right now. What else would you do?
I would certainly pray a lot. I would get involved in some job hunting group. I wouldn't try to do my job hunt all by myself.
How would you find the right group, and what is the benefit of praying? Well, I'm sorry, those two questions, but let's go to we're doing it in order. Praying. For, you know, obviously I'm an atheist, you know that, and so yeah. It's, you know, but most of our people who listen to the show, most people in the world are not atheists. So explain for us, Dick, what is it, how is prayer helpful?
I just believe there are influences that we cannot see. I'll start with air. I'll start with the wind. I think there's a lot of stuff in this universe that is not apprehended by our senses, but is very real. I think that when I pray, I open up pathways between myself and some of those forces. I don't even know all the forces there are, but I just believe there's a whole universe beyond our sight, beyond our senses, that I want to be connected with as much as I would be connected with humans through LinkedIn. So prayer is my going to try to build those linkages.
Great. And yeah, believe me, just because I am not religious doesn't mean I don't have respect for religious people, and certainly you, so please, no apologies about that at all. You said you would also join a group. How would you find the job hunters group that would feel right for you?
Well, that's relatively easy. You go to a career site, it's called job-hunt.org.
Right.
It's run by a friend of mine, Susan Joyce.
She's wonderful.
Yeah, she is a jewel, and she has taken the time and the trouble. God, I don't know how on earth she did
I know.
But she has gotten a compilation of all the job hunting groups by mm-hmm. state, by city, by area. So you go to her website, you look for the listing of job hunting groups, you dial in the state, you dial in the area where you are, and she'll tell you exactly what groups there are.
Yeah, that is a great gift. That is truly great. What I want to go to the well one more time. What's one more thing that Dick Bowles would do, other than going to LinkedIn and finding out what other journalists at age 40 were, you know, able to find a job, to praying and joining a job search group? What else would Richard Nelson Bowles do to find himself a job?
I'm very big, especially now, since I'm not 40, I'm very big on the concept of invention. And I believe that all of us have some inventiveness in our nature. And when I am going to go job hunting, I want to be different from, say, 19 other people that are competing for the same kind of position. The way I do that is I start to think to myself, what are the tasks I would be doing in this job? You mentioned journalists. So I say I still like to be a journalist, maybe not for a newspaper, maybe it's for something else, but I still want to basically do that. I would ask myself a simple question. The question is, why do we do it this way? And by that, I mean, I'd look at everything I would be doing as a journalist from morning until night, and I would ask myself, why do we do it this way? And I'd try to think if there's another way of doing it that might be more creative, might be faster, might be more thorough, whatever. I just let my imagination, I picture myself doing the task, and I'd keep saying, why did we do it that way? And I would try to put my finger on something that would distinguish me so that when I am job hunting, I'm able to say, what makes me unusual is I do this way.
Very good. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest is Richard Nelson Bowles. Dick Bowles is the author of What Color Is Your Parachute? The biggest selling career guide of all time. As I've said at the top of the show, the Library of Congress named it one of the 25 books that have most shaped readers' lives. quite an amazing statement. What a privilege that must feel like to have written that. Especially as a religious guy, I'm sure you believe that God, in part at least, has given you the gifts to make that happen. Is that right?
Yeah, I got fired. And then what happens when you get fired is you discover the maxim that I believe we should all live by, and that is it isn't what you see, it's what you notice. Hmm. And you take somebody who's been fired, he notices things that people who haven't been fired don't notice. And so when I found a new job, the first thing I noticed was how many of the guys that I was supervising, I had a territory in that covered the 9 western states. The people I was supervising, I noticed, because I had been through the experience, I noticed when they were in peril with their own jobs. And so I paid large attention to that, and that led to my doing the research that resulted in What Color Is Your Parachute.
Yeah, that's turning, certainly. I would just simply call that turning lemons into lemonade.
You call it whatever you want to, Marty.
All right. Okay, so now let's turn to the macro question. Dick, as you know, I spend a lot of time, I worry by nature, just my nature. When we were off the air, right before you came on the show, you said, Marty, don't fret. but one of the things that I worry most about is not, even though I'm an elitist at my core, I believe in investing in our best and brightest, but I am more humanly, as a human being, worried about the half of Americans, the 150 million Americans, who are not going to be the knowledge workers. They're not super smart. They are not highly driven and motivated people. They may have come from difficult family backgrounds. These are low-skill people. And what is going to happen to those 150 million Americans in an ever more competitive job environment? What is going to happen to them, and what does society need to do? What are your thoughts?
First of all, Marty, there are 137 million, maybe 138 million people who do have jobs.
Yep.
And not all of them are high knowledge workers.
Nope, but there's going to be a hell of a lot of them who, as you know, in this ever tougher economy, who are not, who are going to have a hell of a time. There's
I don't disagree with you for a moment. I just want to say, just because they aren't knowledge workers doesn't mean they're condemned to never find a job.
Yeah, but as I was looking at the unemployment results that just came up, the jobs that are open are service jobs at restaurants and cleaning jobs that don't pay a living wage. There are crappy jobs which often don't have health care. And ugh, I mean, that's the problem. And then, yeah, I'll stop there.
Yes, I agree with you on your diagnosis. I just don't agree that it covers everybody.
No, of course not. But let's look at the solutions. It's up to you, Dick. I actually emailed you in advance my little 3-part prescription for what should be done, but I would much rather hear yours if you'd like to start with that, or we can start with mine. What do you prefer?
Let's start with neither of us. Let's start with a man named Frank Laubach.
Okay, never heard of him.
His name was spelled L-A-U-B-A-C-H.
Okay.
He was in the Philippines. He was an American. He was in the Philippines, and he noticed that there were vast numbers of people who couldn't read. So he started out to change that. And I use him as my model of what I would like to see happen in the midst of this terrible permanent class of unemployed people that you've been so concerned to help, or at least to discuss what can be done.
Help, yeah.
The thing he did is he came up with the idea with regard to illiteracy, each one teach one. And during his lifetime, he taught 60 million people how to read in 315 languages with his basic thesis, look, we can't do a kind of a reach down from the top to solve this problem, so let's reach up from the bottom. Let's each one of us who knows how to do this, and it was reading in his case, I'm talking about job hunting in our case, let's each one who knows how to do this take as a personal crusade that they have to go teach one other person how they successfully find work themselves, so that one other person profits from their experience. If we had this nationwide or even global each one teach one idea that Laubach used so successfully with language and teaching people to read, we could revolutionize what's happening in the world. My pessimism is that there isn't enough will among people to do that. And the reason I take that sad view is that while I think that is the solution, I doubt the will of the people to do it because I read blogs all the time, and whenever somebody comes up with a solution to a problem, I often see so many people posting to respond to that article or whatever it is with their pet theory about why we are powerless. And this week I saw one blog after another saying it's because we ship jobs overseas, there's nothing we can do about that, and so on. I just don't believe that kind of philosophy is helpful, and I wish there were some way we could get this idea of each one teach one going so that we could have that kind of help for the people that are otherwise going to be just the lost generation, I think.
To what extent is do you believe in your heart of hearts that the concept of, you know, if we could encourage more volunteerism or one-on-one coaching, essentially, of people, of mentoring of people, to what extent do you believe it would help us? I mean, compete with a world in which the average worker does make a dollar a day, no benefits, etc. How is our companies going to, you know, you take somebody who is struggling, let's say, to learn to read, and so let's say you're a magician and you're able to take them from a third grade or fifth grade reading level and move it to a sixth grade level or a seventh grade. This person is, how are these people going to still compete how are we going to get corporations to hire these people at living wages when they can either not hire, automate, hire smart knowledge workers, or offshore at a dollar a day?
Well, basically, the idea is that a lot of people, a lot more than now, what currently the statistics are, 1 out of every 10 workers is self-employed. We need more than 10% to start their own enterprises, their own businesses, and so on, so they aren't at the mercy of these policies, these stupid policies the corporations have, where they evaluate every person in terms of what's the ultimate cost going to be to me, and if it's high health care and so on, they will restrict their hiring.
Yeah. I think entrepreneurship is indeed a part of the problem. I think one teach one is part of the problem. So now I want to share a couple in my mind.
Yeah, go ahead.
I agree with you that we can't count on the nation, you know, rising up and everybody mentoring somebody else, although I think it would be a good leadership move, a good bully pulpit move for Obama to encourage it. I like it. But I think there, to fill in the gap, I think there are a lot of unfilled jobs right now. They're not even created jobs. They're not even jobs, but there's needs out there. It both ends of the age continuum, that is, children and seniors. I think there's a great deal of need for tutoring children, and there's a great deal of need for people who are elderly and basically are unable to take care of themselves. And I'm not talking about the rich. The rich go and hire caretakers. But there is a need for low-level folks to teach Johnny to read The Cat in the Hat, who's slow at learning, in one-on-one tutoring in school and after school, in the classroom and after. And for Granny, who forgets to take her medication or doesn't walk so she's at risk of getting blood clots in her legs, to come in and spend a few hours every day with Granny to make sure she does those things. That's millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of little jobs. And because the poor can't afford to hire them, that's perhaps where the government creates jobs. Unlike the WPA, where they were building parks, that was little niceties in the Roosevelt administration. Today we have more dire needs. The tutoring and taking care of the aging post, the pre-boomers, whatever you want to call them, older than boomer generation, the World War II generation. What do you think of that as a partial solution to the problem?
How are you saying that's a partial solution to the problem?
Because all that, there are, those 150 million people are not bright. They are not driven. They are not employable at living wages in the corporate sector. But if the government paid them $12 an hour plus benefits to go into Granny's house to, you know, every day for 3 hours, that creates a job they can do. And that will create at least a livable wage, as well as helping Granny, as well as helping the kid who needs tutoring and learning how to read The Cat in the Hat.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with your characterization of the 150 million as not very bright. Some of them are terribly bright. It's just they have skills that our society doesn't want right at the moment.
Okay, that's fine. But there's still a lot of folks who are not hireable.
I agree. And, you know, first of all, what you say makes sense to me, but I don't think there's the political will to ever do it. What would make a lot of sense to me, my wife is always teasing me. She said, why don't you go into government? And I said, no, I don't like frustration.
Right. The bureaucracy is liberating.
I have a low tolerance of frustration when somebody else is in control and they have no common sense. But if I were in charge of trying to figure out what to do to help the nation through this kind of post-recession freezing of jobs and freezing of the problem of unemployment, the first thing I would do is I would assume that we are not the only people, not the only nation in the world that's facing this problem. I have a lot of solid evidence that that's true.
That's no question.
So any common sense person does.
Right.
So I would commission somebody to go look at countries that are making some kind of stride in dealing with this problem. I would not assume we had to solve it all by ourselves. I would assume there's somebody in some countries where they've been able to induce the government or the people in decision-making places to experiment and see if this works and that works. It's got to be an era of experimentation where we don't. I heard some speakers at a Google conference about 3 or 4 weeks ago. And they said, one guy was the head of a big corporation, and he said, I came in and I started out with a philosophy, let's try anything and everything, but as soon as we see it isn't working, drop it. Don't keep pummeling it and trying to make it produce fruit when it's obviously barren. And I think that's the spirit we need. We need to look at what is it other countries are doing. We don't live in isolation anymore as far as our problems are concerned, and we shouldn't live in isolation anymore in trying to solve the problems. There's a lot of wisdom in some of these other countries, Scandinavia, for example, and others, and we need to know what they're doing that works. Let them be the guinea pigs because they're already ahead of us in these matters. Let them be the guinea pigs, but let's profit from their experience and learn what is working and try to place that in the context of the U.S.,
I do like the idea of stopping what doesn't work, yet we don't have political will to do it. The data, for example, on job retraining programs is that they're mammothly wasteful. They cost over 100,000.
I couldn't agree
more. Right. So, but, you know, what politician would dare say they're not going to be an advocate of job retraining? So you're right. Politically, it's not going to happen, but you're right. It's critical that we do it. I want to end this segment with two of my thoughts. You talked about the importance we need to have more entrepreneurs. There's a lot of people who are self-employed because they have to be, but they don't really have the skills to be successful. If Marty Nemko was the education czar, Marty Nemko would instantly create a entrepreneurship curriculum through the grades, from classes starting lemonade stands or baking cookies in the elementary school and learning how to develop a business, to through college, instead of a requirement that we learn art history. I would far sooner require a course in how to really start and succeed in a business. So that would be one thing I would do. You agree, disagree?
Totally.
Second, I would cut the birth rate. And I would do it, of course, ethically and voluntarily. But right now, we know if you have 4 or 5 or 6 children, you are really at risk of not being able to be self-sufficient. So especially at schools that have high teen pregnancy rates and there are 3 and 4, and they have 3 or 4 or 5 kids by the time they're 18, I would make sure that there was really full and comprehensive sex education and the availability, not of course coercion or requirement, of Norplant, which is when a kid is 15 or already 16 or 14, and some of these kids are 12 and they're sexually active, and getting pregnant at age 14 and not having abortions, I would make available the option of having Norplant so they don't, which is a long-term birth control that that dissolves by the time they're 17 or 18 or whatever, and would encourage that. What do you think?
It sounds a little draconian to me.
I said encourage. Draconian is coercive. I said
no,
about five times.
I just mean it's treading on free will a lot.
Nope. I am saying encourage. There is no treading on free will. Freely, non-coercively. But I think...
So you're talking about education?
Yes, I said comprehensive sex education, including making available the option of Norplant for young teens to avoid their getting pregnant if they're sexually active.
Yeah. You know, they just released a study this week on sexual practices in America, which was very interesting because it came up with a lot of conclusions, one of which was the population that uses condoms the most are the young teenagers and young 20-year-olds.
Right. Good, well, good for them. That's good. But
no, I mean, we've made some strides in dealing with the very problem you're talking about.
On that optimistic note, one last question about the new 2011 edition of your book, What Colors Your Parachute? Just came out. What is the one or two things you're most proud of that are different in the 2011 edition of What Colors Your Parachute?
Well, my view of my book is that it's a book of hope masquerading as a job hunting manual. And so I worked very hard on the first two chapters, the brand new chapters, of creating a basis for hope. I cite the statistics from Jolt and so on to show there are always vacancies appearing, and this thing that the media loves, there's six people out of work for every vacancy, which is a bunch of poppycock, because every job always has competition. So what on earth does that mean?
Well, I know that there are hundreds of people applying for each individual job, very dozens or hundreds.
No, that's not true. They're applying for certain kinds of jobs.
Yes.
If you create a new Walmart, you'll have a line going around the block.
Exactly.
But it's only certain kinds of jobs that have those that severe competition.
Yeah, if you have a PhD in astrophysics,
there's always going to be competition.
Well, but the competition is fierce. I was so shocked when I saw that there was an ad for a meter reader for the Tacoma, Washington Water District, paying $17.76 an hour, a boring meter reader job. They got 1,600 applicants.
Yeah, because of the pay.
Well, it's not such great pay. That's barely a living wage.
I don't care. It's a lot better than what many jobs offer, which is around $10 an hour.
My point is the competition is enormous. I want to give you the last word. Any one thing you either want to tell me about the book or anything, one more thing you want to leave with our listeners?
Well, I just think that we've got to, each of us, roll up our sleeves and work a lot harder. This isn't a crisis just of unemployment. It's a crisis of the work ethic in our country. And we've all got to learn to work a lot harder at our lives than we've been accustomed to doing.
It's sad, but probably true. Anyway, Dick Bowles, thanks very much for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco.
You're very welcome, Marty.
Yep, the 2011 edition of What Colors Your Parachute is just out. In the 10 minutes or so we've got left, I would like to invite you to call. My job is to give you specific hope. So, you know, not generically, I want to give you something practical that you can do to improve your career. Whether you're unemployed, underemployed, self-employed, or well-employed but still unhappy, and you are looking for a tidbit, you are looking for a direction, I invite you to call. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco for what I call a 3-minute career makeover or job tune-up, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Well, I'm waiting for the calls to come. I guess we do have a call right away, so let's just go right to the phones. And in just a second. Yes. Okay. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. You're on the air. Hello? Are you there? Hello?
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, I have some comments about what I heard you and Mr. Bowles talking about.
Okay.
I think the WPA, you said that they did frivolous things, and I think that that is really, really wrong. They built roads, they built schools, they built public buildings, they built everything that this country needed as far as infrastructure, and we really need that again. I think if the government was smart enough, they seem to be awfully stupid these days, and would institute a WPA program, I think a lot of the unemployment would disappear.
Yeah, as I said, what I meant was, and I think, and I visited the Oakland Rose Garden, this mammoth Rose Garden that was built with WPA funds. I'm sure that the WPA did well, but what I'm trying, and I argued in favor of a public works program that would do more mission critical things in the year, as I said, in the year 2010. That is, helping shut in elderly and helping tutoring kids.
No.
Why no?
Because, you know, you were talking about somebody working, you know, like 3 hours a day, $36, you know.
You didn't, you know what? I said.
Those aren't the kind of jobs that are going to make a difference. The kind of jobs that make a difference.
You see three people a day, and so you make a living.
I don't think so. Also, the other thing that Mr. Bowles said about people in this country not working hard enough, that is insane. People in this country work harder than any other nation.
I know, we are working
hard. And, you know, one of the things that's really crappy as far as the job market is my daughter, who is extremely talented and is working for Oracle at this time. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't get a job that's not a non-contract job. Sure, she's getting $90,000 a year, but there's no security.
Nope.
There's no benefits.
Nope.
It stinks.
Well, you know, I am of two minds. Part of me agrees with you completely that, you know, it's tough to be constantly having to run from job to job. You have a three-month contract, and then you move on. And then there's a part of me, though, that I think back to, you know, and frankly, in government, when I go to the federal government and I see these people, they have lifetime job security and they do nothing. Or I look at teachers who are, you know, once they get tenure after 2 or 3 years, as we see in the movie Waiting for Superman, but in general, some teachers are wonderful, of course. But there are also many other teachers that when they know they've got their job security for life, they get lazy or, you know, repeat the same old lessons again and again and again, and the result is that the kids suffer. I want to go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air.
Hey, I loved how you redirected Richard Bowles in your questions.
Thank you.
Even your ideas on teen pregnancy. I've long thought that schools really need to get back to simple scientific education, and it's amazing how the hygiene classes I had in the 1970s are considered controversial today. Who would have thought that teaching kids how not to get pregnant would still be controversial?
Yeah,
so, yeah, they should learn that.
Absolutely.
Anyway, just to be specific, in a LinkedIn profile, what do you recommend that a recommendation? They have this area where you have recommendations from employers or colleagues.
Right.
What should that contain?
Well, it should contain, you know, everybody can get good recommendations. So, again, this is a competition. You're competing for jobs. You want to get recommendations that are from people who write with filled with detail about what makes you special, makes you great. Just some little generic, short little recommendation ain't going to work. And, you know, this is not rocket science. The more of that quality of recommendation you can get, the better. I would list the most impressive ones first. That's all, nothing magical, but you do need to if you're using LinkedIn for job seeking or just even enhancing your, just wanting to enhance your professional reputation, you do have to get some really strong references, not just references. Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to the next calls. Take as many as we can. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. Hello? It is you. Hello, are you there? Okay, last time. Let's go back to the let's go to the next line. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air.
Hey there. I just wanted to make a comment about the caller talking about the WPA.
Yep.
I guess the thing that I'm seeing here is that, you know, I really don't see any way that our current government is going to let that happen, considering that it would, you know, possibly take away from the profits of the corporations that, you know, tend to be really where the money tends to be going.
And, you know, those kind of shoot from the hip opinions. I don't know. If anybody, I mean, I don't know. I know nobody really knows, but I would, everything about Mr. Obama and his administration and the Democratic Party controlled Congress suggests that they, while they are indeed subject to corporate influence, but if anybody cares about creating jobs for the poor, it's those guys. And I don't know, you know, you're going to have the Socialist Workers Party elected? Not going to happen. I don't know. That's what I think. I think you're right. We've developed a country that is based on tons of checks and balances and so many layers of government and agencies. So, city government, county government, state government, federal government, different agencies, what they call interstitial agencies that operate in between. You know, it's built to ensure that change occurs slowly and that decisions end up being major compromises because we were in a democracy. This is not a fiefdom. This is not a monarchy. So you're going to always have a situation where it's what everybody can agree with because it's a majority wins. So to get 50, in some cases, you know, a two-thirds majority to approve of anything, if it's, you know, because these are nationally representative, every district, you know, conservative districts and liberal districts, you're always going to have very incremental changes in any direction. And maybe that, and that, some people say that is the wisdom of the founders. It is the wisdom of a democracy. Some would say it ensures a tepid responds, when I think about any kind of a decision about a program, if it's made by committee, yes, there's the advantages that come from getting multiple input, but it's invariably tepid. It's invariably modest. My big project right now, maybe my biggest project of my life, most important, is I'm trying to create something called Utopia U, Utopia University, which is a series of 30 courses. There would be no majors. Everybody would get a degree, a bachelor's in what I call professional studies. And what would be involved in that is courses in critical thinking, courses in writing, entrepreneurship, artistic appreciation, interpersonal communication, communication at work, job hunting, finding a career, all of the most important things to succeed in life. And I'm going to have each course taught online by not one university's professors, but the finest, most transformative, inspirational, clear teaching instructor in the world, using a lot of immersive simulations, video, text, and mini lectures. So, and I may be doing this on Wikipedia, where there'll be group input, or I'll try to do this myself under the auspices of, the Bill Gates Foundation or whatever. But that is, but that's the kind of idea that if it was created by a committee, could never be brought into fruition. It would take forever. There'd be endless compromise. Everybody insists, oh, you have to have a course in psychology. How could you not have a course in psychology? And then there'll be this whole debate on the validity of psychology as a profession. Is it too much hocus pocus? Oh, but what about sociology? We're so much a function of, but if I unilaterally make decisions, sure, some of them are arguable, but I can be quite bold and get it done than if everything was done by committee. So that's the problem with government, with a democracy. The problem, of course, with a monarchy is worse. You get autocratic rule. You get Hitlers. You get serfdoms. And that's why Winston Churchill was probably right when he said that democracy is the worst possible form of government, except for all the rest. Anyway, that is all the time we've got today for Work with Marty Nebko. I want to thank my board operator, Debbie Kennedy, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do 3-minute career makeovers on callers, and very rare, I'm going to be taking a week off. And so you're going to hear a best of Work with Marty Nebko. In fact, a best of Work with Marty and Barbara Nebko. We are going to replay this. One of my best shows, I looked through all last year's shows, and what was the best show? It was a show in which Barbara and I discussed, all right, we didn't just discuss, we pleasantly fought about whether it's wisest to take vacations, staycations, or no-cations. Plus, there were some 3-minute career makeovers. Good show, I promise you it will be. Anyway, until next Sunday, this is Marty Nebko reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.
More than 500 of Marty Nemko's published articles and chapters from his book, Cool Careers for Dummies, are free on his website. From there, you also can email him if you'd like coaching on your career or want to comment on this program. His site, martynemko.com, that's MartyNemko.com. And join Marty again next Sunday morning at 11 for Work with Marty Nemko here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco Local Public Radio.